This podcast episode is sponsored by Statera. Statera is a web-based application that helps youth athletes and their stakeholders estimate training load, track maturation status, monitor readiness, and manage injury. Put together by coaches working with busy youth athletes, Statera helps keep things simple and brings together the most important training information in one place to ensure that effective athlete-centered decisions can be made. No more complicated Excel tutorials and spreadsheets. Just upload your athlete's data and their training schedule and start to take control of their training commitments and workload. Make more informed decisions and protect your athlete's well-being, supporting their performance. Statera takes your data very seriously. GDPR compliant and registered with the ICO, choose from a range of maturation indices and validated measures, or customize your own. Statera can record any training variable, and all your data is fully exportable. To reach out today and get a free walkthrough, head over to www.statera.uk. That's STATERA.UK. Welcome to the LTID Network podcast. I'm your host, Rob Anderson, and today I'm speaking with Ash Cox. Ash's academic foundations include three undergraduate degrees in strength and conditioning, sports and exercise science, and exercise rehabilitation. Additionally, he has postgraduate qualifications in sports and exercise medicine and nutrition, whilst working towards a PhD in sport and exercise science. Throughout his career, he's lectured and worked at various academic institutions and presented at some of the leading educational resources, including Chester University and TRA Performance. He's worked with a broad range of sportsmen and women at elite and amateur level, including tennis, MMA, rugby, Olympic winter sports, boxing, and horse racing. He's also presented to Premiership football academies on athlete optimization, specifically strength development, to optimize performance and minimize injury. Ash also has a keen interest in supporting the general population and sits as a member of the Faculty of Public Health. Welcome to the podcast, Ash. It's awesome to have you on. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on the new role. It's fantastic news.
Yeah, chuffed a bit. Absolutely made up. Like we were saying before we started, it kind of it connected up quite nicely with my wife, obviously planning our fourth child and stuff. So got like this year to really knuckle down and put everything into it. Not that I wouldn't have anyway, obviously. But yeah, I think that the timeline and the timing of it all is perfect.
Brilliant. So before we dig into your research and, you know, into the kind of narrative there, give us a bit of the story of Ash Cox. What were you like growing up as a youngster sport-wise? How did you develop a love for sport and exercise, and how did that develop into what you're doing now?
So sport-wise, in all honesty, I was useless. Absolutely rubbish at like football, which was typically all that we did coming from the Northwest. With a little bit of rugby. Now, rugby I enjoyed because I could just run at people and try and hurt people, but you obviously can't make a living out of that. So I started to look at other sports. I boxed for a bit and I enjoyed that. But I guess resistance training or weightlifting became a big part of my life when I was about the age of about 11. So I went through the care system and stuff as a child and was fortunate enough within that process to be exposed to a quite a nice school, and ultimately they had weightlifting classes on. So because I was the kid from Kerr at the time, and I don't think it had happened like this now, but they didn't want me doing contact sports with people. So the two or the three choices I think at the time were trampoline and dance or weightlifting. I'm not much of a trampolinist. Dance maybe on a Saturday night. So it was, weightlifting was the natural fit. And for that time, whilst I was in the care of these individuals, I took to weightlifting and kind of followed that through. So when I was returned back to my home for a bit, it's a long story, I bought an old York bench and it had like a little leg extensor on the end. And I used to just sit there in the evening just doing leg extensions, complete overkill. And that's kind of where I fell in love with resistance exercise, I guess. And I didn't really know how much an influence that had had on my life until maybe 20 years later when I found myself researching it for a living.
So when did the military career kind of transition for you? When did that happen?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've probably not painted the picture fully there, but in terms of my upbringing and stuff, I just wanted to get away from it as quickly as possible. So I signed up to join the military bang on 15 and 9 months, so as young as I possibly could, and went into the military. And I had a good career in the military, I think, when you compare to most people relatively. So I went in and joined 29 Commando, where I worked as a forward observer. On the commando course as well, I was awarded a commandant certificate for like exceptional performance. And at the time, I was only 17 years of age, and I was surrounded by fully grown men, seasoned soldiers. So to get that award was quite a nice tick in the box. Went to my unit, became a forward observer, so like calling in fast jets and artillery and mortars and anything that was indirect to support the infantry units was my job. So moving through, got my para wings as well, so did all the jumping out of planes business. So it was a pretty cool job all in all, but you can't do it forever. And then when I met my wife, it was we need to rein this back in now. So I was with my wife when I went to Afghanistan in 2008 and 2009. And I think it puts quite a lot of strain on a relationship. And at the time, it was quite new, quite early on. But I think once we'd come back and we got to know each other more, it was time to take a step back. And to be honest, I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, I'd left school without really finishing my GCSEs. So we didn't have no qualifications and thought, I've kind of screwed it here. I don't really know which direction I'm going to go in. So I ended up having an ankle reconstruction, and that's what took me on the path that I found myself on today. So I went, had an ankle reconstruction, and essentially started the rehab process. And I came across a guy called Danny Watson, who's in the Royal Army Physical Training Corps. And his role is to like rehabilitate injured troops. And I just got well into it, like loved every minute of it. So all like the little physical challenges that were set, but even like the anatomy, the physiology, the biomechanics, and just started to find myself geeking up, and I didn't really know why, and it was all sticking. And for me, nothing had ever really stuck before. So went down that route, did selection, and performed really well on that, came top on anatomy and physiology, and went on to my unit then. So my last posting, I was fortunate enough to do exercise rehabilitation stints at Headley Court. So working like with complex trauma and amputees, which was like super interesting. Down in Poole, the Special Forces, with commando units, and then I finished off in Catterick with the para units there as well, to rehabilitating people who were essentially injuring themselves on P Company. And it's at this point, throughout all this time here in the background, I was doing like my bachelor's degrees. So I did 3 undergrad degrees. It sounds crazy, really, but it was paid for by the military. So it was like, right, well, I'm taking this on, I'm enjoying it, so I'm just going to keep taking it and just build upon my knowledge. And as I was moving through, you have massive imposter syndrome, and I don't think it ever goes away. Even now, you know, getting back onto the podcast, I was like, Rob, I'm not really the person you want to be inviting on here. It's just me. So the imposter syndrome, I don't think will ever go away, but it keeps you on your toes, I guess. But as I went through, I thought, you know, I've got a first class degree in strength and conditioning and merits and distinctions in various other places. And I was like, there's something in this. Maybe I could be a doctor, I said. And I remember saying it, jokingly say it at Catterick. And yeah, lo and behold, that's what I've gone on to pursue.
So you leave the military. What's that next bit, that transition look like into the research side of things and into the academic world? What did that look like?
So far, the story sounds dead cool, doesn't it? But the reality of it was quite grim. So it came to leaving the military, and I'd already identified what I wanted to do for research. So during my time when I was working with the parachute regiment, the guys who were going through P Company, every injury, or more or less every injury that we'd see on a daily basis at least, were lower limb, like medial tibial stress syndrome type injuries, or shin splints as they're better known. And that was a constant. They were always there as an injury pathology. And it got me thinking about strength testing. And in the gym at the time, you didn't even have a squat rack, even though it was a rehab gym. So I yommed up to that, or walked up to military slang, walked up to the gym at the top, bought my own squat rack down, and placed it into the gym to start doing strength testing in these recruits. And during that process is kind of where I went, right, I want to do this for a living now. There's a guy there doing research, you see. So I wanted to move out and pursue that as a career. And being from a military background, it was quite hard to go, I'm going to leave the military and I'm going to go and pursue a PhD, because I just didn't, it was round peg, square hole. It didn't make any sense. So I kind of had to leave and become a civilian, civilianize myself first and foremost. No one would take it for any jobs. I applied for a job at Blackpool Football Club and I went all the way through to the end and they said, no, we can't take you. Someone else got it because they'd had a master's or, and it was just, this was a common theme. I didn't have, in the eyes of the civilian world, even though I'd worked with like commandos and paras and special forces, I didn't have that applied aspect, which in hindsight now I can honestly say, a hand on heart, that was a load of rubbish. Like, I'd been working practice-based and theoretically for years, but there was no carryover as they seen it in the civilian world. So I thought, you know what, I'm gonna have to come out and just kind of cut my teeth at anything just to get out. And the first job I took was as a manager at Aldi when I first came out of the military, and still trying to work through my postgrad at the time. And then I went into medical research, and that wasn't really where I wanted to be sat. It was a great job, but it wasn't my passion. And that was whilst I was doing my PhD. I'd gotten to my PhD by this time. As we kind of alluded to at the beginning, recently landed a job as a lecturer at Edge Hill University.
Fantastic. Yeah, some story, some journey. Like, you get a commitment journey to go through that. I don't think there's too many people who'd be signed up to Aldi as a manager as the stepping stone to a lecturing position. Certainly a bit left field, isn't it? But no, fair play to you for sticking true to what you decided you wanted to go into. So let's dive into your PhD. So, you know, a lot of people may not be familiar that the order in which things gets published is not necessarily the order in which you undertake that work. So talk us through, from your perspective, what that PhD kind of process, I guess, looked like as a journey in terms of your area of interest, how you started to develop the idea and investigate it.
Okay, yeah. So I guess when I was going into the PhD, I think I mentioned earlier that I had this idea in my head that I wanted to get young people stronger in the interest really of enhancing their bone health and trying to minimize injury risks so they could pursue whatever passion, sport, vocation that they wanted to as they got older and moved into young adulthood. And that was based upon some of the practice-based results that we'd seen in the field. I guess when I was working out of Catterick, we were strengthening these guys back up and they weren't coming back to us. And we said, there's something in this. And there was another guy I should really mention, really. So Richie, who was the physio at the time, I think he's like head of clinical services now at Spire. But him and I worked together to get this protocol through. And we based it around the 1.5 times body weight squat, or the 5 reps in 5 seconds at 60% of body weight, which is the NSCA guidelines for plyometrics. May have changed now, but at the time, they were the guidelines. Before someone could go into a plyometric program, that's what they'd do. So comes doing a PhD, met with my supervisor, Stuart Fairclough, who's been awesome throughout. There's no way I'd be talking about any of this if it wasn't for Stuart. And also Rob Noonan as well, the other supervisor. But when they laid out the plan, essentially it has to follow this cycle. And we spoke about the complex intervention cycle, which starts off with putting the proposal forward for the PhD, but then looking at a systematic review and meta-analysis and then moving through the journey there. So that's where the journey starts, I guess, was a systematic review and meta-analysis into adolescent resistance training. And Stuart's area of expertise is very much about using the school as the environment to deliver these interventions. Because as many of us know, that area, if you like, or the school environment is ideal to capture a lot of young people in one go and almost irrespective of their background demographics as well. So for me, coming from a deprived background, for example, I didn't and wouldn't have the access to a David Lloyd gym, as an example, whereas in a school environment, we're increasing the chances to expose them to something that they might not get exposure to typically. So we structured it around using the school environment, and the question was posed first, is it even worth pursuing? Are these muscular fitness-based interventions worth pursuing first and foremost? And that's where the systematic review and meta-analysis came into it. And initially, we did, there's a preprint service now. So we went through the whole systematic review process. and we upload it as a preprint. So there's two papers out there with a very similar title. And one's looking at the efficacy of school-based interventions for improving muscular fitness outcomes. And then there's one that's muscular fitness outcomes and moderate to vigorous physical activity outcomes, and kind of comparing the two. When it came through, so that went into preprint. And then when it came through to publisher of Sports Med, the reviewers basically came back and said, look, you know, maybe just focus on the muscular fitness aspect, because the paper was huge when we looked at both. And I think moderate to vigorous physical activity has been done. It's been hammered. And, you know, if you look at the literature, there's not much traction with regards to getting anything back, despite all the research and the interventions that are being put in place. So this then made it quite novel. And to really hone in on an area, I based off my experience personal, so myself doing resistance-based exercise, but also with the men who were worked with within the parachute regiments and the Gurkhas and all the rest of it. So we went down the male adolescent path. And that was important, not just from a kind of personal bias, if you like, from seeing that and being exposed to that environment, but also because the literature suggests that adolescent males may be more inclined to participate in like these strength-based activities because they perceive them as more masculine to an extent. And that's been well cited in the literature. And I think if you look at the work of, you know, David Lubins and his Australian team over there, they've covered that in depth. So that was why we went down the adolescent boy route. And what we found is that muscular fitness did have a small to moderate impact on improving the outcomes. So we just had to kind of lump the outcomes together because there's issues within the literature with regards to differentiating between hypertrophy, muscular endurance and power. They don't differentiate. So it was quite difficult to kind of put them into a box. But we did manage to do it. So we looked at the protocols and we broke it down to like traditional forms of resistance-based activity, plyometrics and body weight as well. And what we found is that the more resistance-based activity that was based around traditional methods, so weightlifting, machine-based activity, they had a good effect. They worked really well. But the problem that we kind of argued in the discussion with that is that schools would typically in that instance need access to equipment, specialist equipment, so barbells, the machines themselves to conduct the movements, and also as well that we're relying on the teachers having that knowledge to start off with. So that raised some more concerns that we pursued later on in the PhD. What we also seen is that the plyometric aspect, which as we both know, doesn't really take much in terms of equipment, arguably. And without going really in depth on plyometrics, it doesn't take much in the form of knowledge in terms of the delivery of it. Now, we know that's a very bold statement because plyometrics themselves, once you get into it, are an extremely complex training methodology. Certainly when you take into account growth and maturation and certain contact times and how to progress in load. To progress them through that plyometric protocol is quite difficult unless you dive into the research because it's not readily available. And that raises some concerns for people who are going to deliver it in the public sphere. And not to, I won't mention names, but there are people out there who do plyometric type activity. They might have a YouTube channel and they delivered it during lockdown. And I watched one of them. And the amount of contacts that go on during this 20, 30, 40 minute session was just unreal. And it's not a power-based session by that point. And I had my reservations around whether that was actual true plyometric training. So that was the systematic review and meta-analysis. So we at this point now, we've said, right, it works. We've proven it works in adolescent boys. Where do we go from here? And the next stage then was to make it more of a participant-based research then from that point onwards. So we wanted to do a mixed methods investigation and we wanted to get the viewpoint of these adolescent boys and also try and marry it up with what we're actually seeing in terms of their muscular fitness outputs. When we actually started doing the focus groups and this write, draw, show, tell methodology, So they draw a picture around somewhere where they'd be active. We started seeing these kind of themes emerge that were, they want to engage in this type of activity, but they're now telling us that you just don't feel as though they have the exposure to it, and they don't have the facilities, access to the facilities to be able to engage. And these were adolescent boys, you know, we're talking late stages of secondary school education, who in essence are going to leave secondary school, sign up to a gym and be expected to know what they're doing. And again, that raised further concerns. And I think when we went through the focus group interview process as well, one of the first questions that we posed to these adolescents were, what are the physical activity guidelines? You know, what is moderate to vigorous? What is resistance-based training? And to be honest, they didn't really know, which when we think about what the role of physical education is, or one of the elements of physical education, it's about getting these individuals ready for lifelong physical activity. And what we see in physical education, and certainly what's reported in the literature and what our findings were, is that there's an over-reliance on team-based sport. And that's not indicative of what we see post-formal education. So you only have to look at, you know, the Sport England surveys are a really good example of this, to see what kind of activities adults are doing. And typically, as we all know, it's gym-based activity. So they'll be going to the likes of your, you know, your council gyms, your pure gyms, wherever it may be, to conduct those types of activity. And that begs the question then, do they actually know what they are doing? There were some interesting points that came out of the paper itself. So without calling out the PE teachers, I've got very good relationships with the teachers I engaged with. So they are helping me out with my last kind of study. And I think they admittedly now that they'll say, oh, we're not too sure what we're doing. And the students seen that, and they highlighted that as well in this paper. And they said, look, we don't think the teachers want to do it because they don't know how to do it. So that led us on then to the next element of the PhD. And that was essentially to do a national survey. So all four home nations, so all the PE teachers, and these findings haven't been released yet. So I'll kind of be careful what I'm saying. We're at the end of the manuscript process as we speak. But I presented some of the findings to the Ispen Power Conference a couple of months back. And we had some really interesting, you know, outcomes from that. So we've seen that essentially these teachers, they need more training. They need to be given not just the ongoing kind of continued professional development opportunities, but they also need some foundational training laid down. And this, there was similar research done in America back in, I think it was 2012, I think it was, when they did, they just give them a test to see where they were at. And they scored well on the like traditional sports, did okay on the aerobic work. But when it came to resistance activity, the teachers were, they were at a bit of a loose end. They weren't up to date on the foundational knowledge and how to program and periodize it for it to be effective. You know, as we said before we came on, we can make a kid do press-ups and pull-ups and squats and whatever else until we're blue in the face, but are we actually going to achieve anything? Probably not. And that's, you know, that came up in some of those findings. So the idea is the last study, which is, it's just at the end of its development. So I've had the teachers involved in putting this together, is there's going to be a CPD like framework that's going to go out for the teachers to enroll into as a bit of a feasibility study to see whether essentially they use it and utilize it and get some feedback from them and see how effective it is in enhancing and increasing their knowledge. So that's kind of a whistle-stop tour on the phases of my PhD to date.
Yeah, that really makes a lot of sense. I'm just thinking, as you're thinking that marries up with my experience. I mean, one of the first experiences I had as an S&C coach down in Bournemouth in probably 2013 was, you know, training a young athlete in the gym while a PE teacher was taking a class, telling them all how resistance training would stunt your growth and you shouldn't lift weights. Meanwhile, I've got this kid scoring. And I'm, you know, we kind of look at each other and I'm going, did you just say that? So yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense as we moved away from this movement-based PE curriculum approach of the 60s and 70s towards this games-based approach, that's where their strengths are. And, you know, there's maybe less, you know, understanding or expertise in those other areas that perhaps we're used to. And as you pointed out, it's not necessarily the teacher's fault, you know, unless they have an active interest in weightlifting or powerlifting or bodybuilding or whatever it is, they're probably not going to have that base level if they've not been provided at a university or through CPD. So, you know, not that it's a finger pointing exercise, it's just, you know, black and white, is that actually maybe by scaling back on these activities and promoting more of the games based stuff, the flip side of that is when we do want that expertise to be there, it's not there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even just through the PhD cycle as I've gone through and liaised with the teachers, I've tried to have them involved in the process as much as possible, certainly when it's come to doing the CPD. And just when we've had these conversations, even what would appear to be basic foundational knowledge, so, you know, getting stronger is going to enhance motor competence, for example, that's like light bulb moments for some of them. So I had a guy who was a rugby specialist, and when we had the discussion around increasing their motor competence because they're engaging in physical, you know, muscular fitness based physical activity, he was like, oh, well, we also be doing it. And was telling me what we've been saying for ages. So it's quite interesting to see that we could probably get a lot of benefit from just giving them the tools and the knowledge to empower them to then move forward and deliver it and not be afraid of, as you alluded to, damage them or stunt their growth, which just, I don't think it's based on any solid research at all. I think there was one paper from the 1980s, which this is all based around, and I just don't think it's gone away.
Yeah, totally. There's obviously still kind of those old myths, but it's really interesting. I mean, you know, marrying up with just the recent interview I did with James around releasing the, you know, the YPD model that the LTID network has, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is fill that gap to go, okay, you know, it's not a case of whose fault is it? It's there's this need to upskill teachers, whether, you know, whether it's a PE teacher or it's an, you know, a science teacher who's also doing the athletics coaching after school. You know, there's a need for understanding of how do I program this, or how do I progress this, or what's a low intensity plyometric and a high intensity plyometric? And I think that's where, you know, we can really serve as many kids as possible. Because as you've alluded to early on, the best environment to get hold of kids and get them started down a path of physical activity for sport or for life is that school situation. And we're really not maximizing that.
No, not at all. No, and I think the school environment is, it should sit central to developing this lifelong engagement with physical activity. And I'm very much towards, and I think, again, we spoke earlier that I've moved away from the performance aspect of sports and exercise science. So it's great that I've had, you know, Olympians, I've had people move through the MMA circuit, and that's been fantastic and really interesting. But I think what really drives me to do this work is it's the health, and seeing an individual who is disengaged from physical activity because they don't perform well at traditional, like aerobic based or team based activity, and giving them a barbell and seeing them be able to lift more than their peers. And then that empowers them then to pursue other forms of physical activity. And it's important that we get that message across that it's not going to be for everyone, but on the flip side, neither is sport. It doesn't fit everyone's narrative. And we've got an ever-increasing obese or overweight nation, and just the fact that they are obese or overweight, there was a great paper done by, I think it's Tomlinson it was, and he looks at a DEXA scan of obese adolescents and compares the muscle mass as well to a normal weight adolescent. And what you can see in there is that there's an actual increased amount of fat-free mass as well in the obese individual, which makes sense. They're carrying it about. It's almost like chronic loading through the years. And I think if we're clever about it, and Jill Ten Hoare, I don't know if you've seen her work, but she again makes the point that we can actually, from a behavior change, psychological buy-in, if we empower them and we say, look, you know, you are powerful, you're strong, this and that, then you're going to get the buy-in to physical activity. And that could ignite, that could be the spark for lifelong engagement, as opposed to feeling like an extra out of Kez and being made to run around an old sports field in the rain in the middle of the UK. So it does have, there's more to it than just this is resistance training. There's an undertone of trying to get the buy-in from those who may be disengaged from traditional team-based sports.
Yeah, I think that marries up really well with, have you come across the work of Helen Collins at all? I imagine you.
I have. And you spoke to Helen today, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, her work around that same idea of self-concept, but also, you know, those bigger kids that you talk about who maybe are the last pick on the football pitch or the rugby pitch, actually giving them a platform to do something and be good at something in front of their peers, you know, and the impact that has on their self-esteem and their confidence and their self-concept is huge. And as you say, you know, we recognize that elsewhere in the curriculum, they go, okay, you know, maybe you're not great at French, but you're good at maths. Or maybe you're not great at maths, but you're good at science. But when it comes to PE, it's like, okay, sport, competitive sport.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, actually, you know, I have this conversation a lot. The second you tell anyone what you do, they always go, oh, I'm trying to lose weight. You know, what should I do? And my number one piece of advice to people is find something you enjoy doing and do it. You know, whether that's going for a walk or going for a jog or playing tennis or whatever, don't think you have to cram into this box of going for a jog or going to the gym, because every time you wake up and force yourself to do it, you'll hate every second. And as a result, you won't adhere. And what are we essentially saying? We're saying, if we want to set people up on a path to long-term physical activity, let's find something they enjoy. And that might be resistance training.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, what can put people off resistance training sometimes is there is, you know, you hear about, and there's loads on social media, isn't there, about progressive overload, and it sounds scary to people because ultimately we're going to have to test. And in recent years, we've moved away from testing. And again, you kind of alluded to the diversity in the curriculum elsewhere when it comes to ability, but we've stopped almost testing ability in PE as well to be accommodating for everyone. When in actual fact, we could actually be doing them a disservice, because to be truly accommodating, we should take in individuals. We should show them how to calculate their own power output. So that now this makes it cross-curricular. So we're talking to science, we're talking to maths, we're talking to English. So we're working in different, you know, it's not just PE, but we're also saying, look, you know, whatever his name is, you've just jumped this high and that is this amount of power output. And just through what I've seen in schools doing consultancy stuff in the past is it's very much how high can you jump? We'll measure it in centimeters, because they don't have that knowledge. And that's from the teachers, not just from the children. And that if it's not done right from the off, and if you don't structure these sessions appropriately, then it's going to be off-putting still. And that's why I think it's so important that we get the message across. So I think power output is a really good example of that. So just because someone is a little bit larger and they can't jump as high, they might actually have a bigger power output if we're measuring it correctly, which goes back to the whole, you know, we need to be up to date with the literature, we need to understand what we're measuring. Adolescent power output is a prime example of that. So I think there was a paper published only last year that gave a completely new formulation for calculating power outputs in adolescents. I believe that was published in JSS, I think. And this point has been made in the past, but it just doesn't seem to be getting to the trenches. And that's why we've kind of gone now. And instead of doing the traditional, let's deliver an intervention, we've now gone to the teachers. We're like, let's try and empower the teachers now. You know, we know this stuff works. We've done the systematic review. Whereas some people would finish their PhD off with, I'm going to go in and do an intervention. We decided to go, let's empower the teachers. Let's give them the information and the knowledge to carry on and take the torch, if you like, and move forward with it all.
Yeah, I think that's a really fantastic strategy. One of the things, you know, that attracts me to coach education is that opposite, that idea that you can make an impact on so many more athletes. So, you know, if I coach 10 athletes in a class, I've impacted 10, but if I coach one coach, I might have impacted 30 or 40. And I think there is a tendency, perhaps, as you've kind of suggested, that, you know, if I'm doing a research project, I obviously need my own aims and outcomes, and I want to get 50 participants. And, you know, whether they continue beyond the 12 weeks of my study, I don't care, because I've got the data I need. But actually, if we want to be effective, we actually need to kind of, you know, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, that kind of strategy. And actually, if we want to make real impact, it's possibly not going straight to the source of the kids, but as you've alluded to, actually upgrading the skill set and the application of the PE teachers, because then, you know, if they teach for another 10 years, how many kids are they impacting?
Yeah, definitely. They're the cultivators. They're the ones who remain in position when the students move through and come out the other end. And if we can have even the smallest impact of, you know, enhancing, and again, I'm sticking around the area of musculoskeletal health here. It costs the NHS about £2.5 billion a year. And that's measured through hand grip strength. I think for females, it's under 12 kilos and males, it's under 16 kilos of pressure and hand grip strength. But if we can reduce this burden on the NHS, it frees up cash flow. It makes societal changes. It sounds silly, but the actual impact is huge if we get it right.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely massive. And It's funny because we often have this upside down approach, isn't it? Where we have this focus on elite sport, but it doesn't matter, you know, how many people you've got an elite sport program, because the reliance, they need to come through this gateway of physical activity and health to start with. So by, you know, instead of trying to pick the most elite ones and deliver stuff to them, if we're, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats kind of mentality of let's raise the minimum standard of what's delivered to these kids. So our whole talent pool's just improved because now actually we've got 100 kids who can do all these things. And you know, the quality or the average has risen. And as you say, that okay, that has an impact on health, NHS, societal change, as well as, you know, the one or two who may go on to professional sport.
Yeah. And I like to always say that everyone kind of sits on a performance spectrum. You know, so I don't differentiate from coaching some of my elite youth athletes from doing research projects and coaching what we call, you know, essentially novice or amateur individuals to resistance training. And I always say that everyone sits on a spectrum of performance. So whether that's performing just for life, for getting up in the morning, or whether that's performing to go to Tokyo or whatever it may be next. And that's when you start to get the buy-in. Marry that up with some of the tests and the assessments, appropriate ones, and then you can see themselves getting better.
Mm. And ultimately, you know, we all see those kind of, you know, centenarians kind of competing in the, you know, old age Olympics or whatever, but very few people are going to continue to compete in their primary sport for that long. Ultimately, people retire, whether it's through injury or through personal circumstances, life changes, etc. So while you may have had a glamorous career for 10 years, people ultimately move away from elite level competition. In terms of your PhD project at the moment, is this the last study, the last manuscript you're putting together? Is there anything to be completed going ahead?
This will be the last study, yeah. So there's light at the end of the tunnel, I guess, which is exciting. It seems like it's worked out quite nicely. I mean, I've kind of painted a bit of a false picture, I guess, because it looks as though this was always the plan. And in all honesty, with COVID-19 and so on and so forth, the plan did deviate. So initially at the end, it was going to finish off with an intervention. So we'd done the systematic review, we'd done the qualitative research in the adolescent boys, and we were going to deliver this intervention then. But if you think about it, we've already proven that it works. We've looked at the systematic review and meta-analysis. So it just felt like we were just reinventing the wheel. And I was using, you know, a version of a plyometric program protocol that's been tested already. So we knew that it worked. So it didn't seem like I was doing the PhD justice. It seemed like a bit of a lazy ending. And then COVID-19 came, and that meant that I couldn't go into schools. And so it was serendipitous that happened, and I had to change up what the plan was. And that's when I went back to the research committee, the research ethics committee, got new ethics signed off to do the survey. And, you know, the survey, the data that came back was, you know, extremely revealing in terms of the lack of knowledge, but the want as well, and the need for knowledge from teachers from across the UK. And that led us down this path. So it's worked out quite well. And I think it's something to build on. So as someone who's in my early academic career, I feel as though it'd probably take me to retirement trying to investigate and do all the work that I would like to do. So, yeah.
So what does that, I mean, essentially your intervention has gone from working with the young athletes or the school kids themselves to working with the teachers. What does that look like in terms of that intervention of the CPD and the upskilling?
So there's been a few very small CPD projects that have gone on, typically in the States. A lot of the bigger ones have been focused around moderate to vigorous physical activity, and they're not really getting the teachers involved. And if they are, it's still not the area in which I'd like to see a focus on, more of a focus on. So in terms of building it, I've tried to keep the teachers involved as much as possible through the whole process. So I've got a batch of 5 teachers who essentially I can talk to at any point in time. And I've got a WhatsApp group with about 20 to 30 teachers on as well. So I've almost got this constant feedback on the work that I'm doing. And I think when I first started putting the CPD together, it was heavily referenced, probably quite heavy. And they were like, Ash, we don't want this. We just want to know what we need to do, how to deliver it. It's as simple as that. So I kind of had to go back to the drawing board and rehash a lot of the CPD platform itself. But if we can roll out and assess its feasibility and get the feedback, for me personally, I'd love to be able to upscale it and deliver it on a bigger platform once we've, through the process of this PhD, ironed out the niggles and really assess the feasibility of it to try and roll out, yeah, nationally. It would be an absolute dream. And I think you only have to look back to the last iteration of the physical activity guidelines, where I think it was the outgoing chief medical officer at the time, so Dame Sally Davis, actually said in the forward of those physical activity guidelines that we've taken our eye off the ball with muscular fitness. There needs to be more of a focus on it. And we have seen that, and there's more research. And, you know, we had the rapid evidence review from Anna Schulke on behalf of Public Health England that was put out earlier in the year. But I think now we need to start looking at the teachers, gearing the teachers up and giving them the knowledge and the tools to empower them to move forward. That's where I'd like to see it going, you know, even post PhD.
So is that, you know, the course of a, you know, an in-person workshop, or is that an online thing? You know, I guess COVID has affected things, as with everything. So what does that look like for the teachers themselves?
I think COVID's made everything online, hasn't it? So typically, yeah, it'd be an online platform. It'd be an online CPD platform. And when you look through, because it's a bit of a strange one, you're putting it together, you're almost looking at the literature that ensures good CPD practice, and you're looking at also the literature that ensures good delivery to teachers as well. And I think everyone's in a very fast-paced life now. Teachers are busy, and they're only going to get busier on the return back to normal, whatever that may be. And for them to have some flexibility, I think, is key if we're going to get the buy-in and the long-term investment of their own time into such a platform. So yeah, so that's kind of where I see it going. And I've done it before, so I deliver courses for the Royal Society of Public Health, and whereas that used to be person-to-person teaching, that's gone exclusively online now for some of the courses. So again, I can see where the issues are before they've happened. So I'm in a quite a good position, I think, to move forward and build upon that.
Fantastic. So if I was to, I guess, summarize things, it's, we know that particularly adolescent males want to get involved in resistance training, and that schools are the optimum kind of environment to do that. But yeah, there's potentially the barrier of facilities or equipment, but then also the potential barrier of expertise in that those around them, the PE teachers, don't necessarily have that knowledge or that skill set from their training to be able to deliver it to this audience who wants it, which I guess then inevitably means they're going to either go somewhere else to get it, or ultimately outside of that, not have that when they arrive at a public facility gym and ultimately end up doing themselves harm.
Exactly. Couldn't have put it better myself, Rob. That's exactly what this is. Yes.
Fantastic. So, I mean, usually at this point I ask a guest, you know, what's next on the horizon for you? But obviously we know your manuscripts, you know, in that final stage of completion, there'll be a Viva off the back of that. And you're bedding into the new lecturing role. So what does that new lecturing role look like for you at Edgehill?
Well, I don't know. I haven't even found out myself yet. So I've the actual modules that I'm teaching on, I've covered on before anyway, delivering, you know, muscular fitness type activity lectures. So it's a strange place to go to work in, because I've done my PhD there and then I've gone to work there. So it's like I haven't started anything new yet, but I am sure that once things are back to normal in September and everyone's back in, then it'll ramp up. So it's all quite new to me at the moment. I'm just looking forward to getting started.
Fantastic. And I mean, it's the dreaded question that every PhD student, you know, has at the end of their thing, which is what's next, which you've answered. But do you see a postdoc in this area potentially down the line?
I'd love to, yeah, 100%. Like the way I see it is, if you're going to embark on a PhD, and this has been a passion anyway, and I think it has to be a passion to complete a PhD, certainly part-time. And I've spent years trying to get to where I am now. And I think that if you're doing a PhD in an area, that's where your career should go. So I'd like to stay, you know, within paediatric exercise science and not necessarily within elite sport. So everything from, you know, I've got a good rehab background. So looking at maybe Osgood Slatters and how resistance-based activity can impact that, because we're looking at anterior knee pain in adults. We know it works. I don't know what there is in children at the moment. And I think there's the world's my oyster with it. I think anyone who's moving into this area of research will have a lot of work on the hands. There's plenty to investigate. So for me, it is building upon the foundations that I've laid down on a PhD. It seems like the right thing to do, and hopefully to kind of try and have an impact on the health of future generations and to make it an attractive area of research. So traditionally, a lot of it is focused towards moderate to vigorous physical activity with accelerometer work, and whereas this almost feels in its infancy in pediatrics, and I'm not too sure why. It's very odd, even when you look at how the current research is put together. And I think if we don't get a grip of it now, there is a fear that this will run our way and we can't bring it back. But resistance-based exercise and resistance training and muscular fitness all comes into the same, you know, the same umbrella, but we're using different terminology and different terms to explain the same thing. So I think for me, I'd like to get a terminology set in stone so that the whole research community is all talking off the same or singing off the same song sheet, because it'll make our lives easy in the long run. Because if you look at accelerometer stuff now, there's different cut points and different accelerometers will give you different readouts in. So I want to try and instill some continuity from the off, from the very beginning. These are the measures we use. These are the reasons why. And these are the tests that we conduct in the field to try and allow people to move forward and carry the torch forward as well.
Mm. So based on what you know and the research that you've done, what sort of advice would you give for parents, coaches, and I guess in this situation, PE teachers, when it comes to youth populations and physical activity?
So to parents, and being a parent myself, I'd say just let them play with it first and foremost. It goes back to kind of that LTAD system, where I think that's a really good way of structuring it. So it is play from the beginning. And yeah, you've got training to win and that at the top, but ultimately, let them have a go at everything. I mean, I only had my 5-year-old son yesterday, so I run gym classes in the evening for children. It's done through like a charity just to look after disadvantaged children, but my kids, they managed to slot themselves in, which is good. So my 5-year-old was on the rower. He only did 700 meters, wherever it was, but the fact that he's on there just playing and getting used to moving in that setting is only going to pay off later in life. You know, we had him lifting medicine balls up, and we taught some of the kids hip hinge movements and swinging a kettlebell. And so let them play. Don't put too much of an emphasis on this is what everyone else is doing, we've got to follow suit. So we're talking about the likes of football, rugby, hockey, whatever it may be. There's nothing wrong with just taking them to a gym. In fact, it's going to improve other aspects. You know, if we're moving away from that early specialization and just doing football, if we go in the gym, we're going to be able to carry over those skills learned into other aspects of our life. So for me, it's a must to let them play and experiment. And for you to set the example, so parents, I am looking at you. If you're setting the example and the research supports this, certainly during childhood, not so much in adolescence because they look towards their peers, but certainly as, you know, young boys and girls looking up to their parents, get yourselves involved as well. I can't remember his name now, it'll come back to me, one of the Australian research team guys, it might be Jordan Smith, I think. He does a YouTube video with his daughter, which is quite cool, and it's good to see. And I'd love to see more parents doing physical activity with their kids. I mean, I go out running with mine, and people look at you like you're mad because you're taking your young kids on a run. But it's all part and parcel to the buy-in. They ask me to go to the gym now, so when I can't be bothered, when I come home after a long day, they get me out. So yeah, so it's good. So the parents, get involved, let them play, and play with them. You know, we're all kids at heart. When it comes to coaches, don't take it too seriously. There's a lot of coaches who shout at the kids and they're wanting to get the next PB and so on and so forth. So the first thing is, don't take it too seriously. We don't want to put them off. The next thing is, don't be afraid to try something new and to rein it in as well in areas. And what I mean by that is, if you are, as a coach, skilled or competent in delivering weightlifting derivative exercises, so snatches and clean and jerks, then go for it, deliver it. and deliver it to kids who are 7, 8, 9, 10 years of age. At least start with broomsticks, and let's start seeing these movements become the norm as opposed to a specialist or unusual class, which is what we tend to see. So don't be afraid to step outside the box a little bit. Also, don't bow to what, again, is perceived as the norm. So going back to the YouTube sensation, who is delivering his form of youth physical activity during the lockdown, whilst it's fantastic and it's great that the kids are moving, don't be afraid to go, well, we're only going to do 90-foot contacts this session, and this is the reason why, and it's not very much, and we're going to have a real rest in between. Because ultimately, we want to have a focus. Like, we have a focus just like we do with adults. So whether that's power, muscular endurance, make sure there's a rationale to what you're doing. You can't just make them run round. It just doesn't work like that. And going a bit off-piste, if you're just making kids run round anyway, sitting in the heat like we've got today, they don't cool themselves down as well. There's different things that you need to take into account. They overheat quicker, they just pass out, and you're opening up a whole can of worms because you were just trying to make them run around and get sweaty. It doesn't make any sense. So that's the message for coaches. And then for PE teachers, I guess it's just, this is another subject, just like anything else. So science, maths, English, whatever it may be. And there is nothing wrong with assessing an individual to see where they are at. And if I could urge PE teachers to read just one paper, I think it would be the paper called, I think it's by Daniel Cohen and colleagues, and it's called Mounting the Zebra. And they talk about testing, fitness testing in schools, and how it can be useful, not just as a marker to inform what you're going to do next in terms of your teaching and how to support their health and development, but also for their psychological and self-efficacy benefits. So if you're testing right, not only are you going to enhance the quality of your PE provision, but you're also going to make a more inclusive and engaging environment for the kids who are involved. So I think it's really important to, across all three, parents, coaches and teachers, not to bow into the societal norms, whatever they may be. People are scared to go outside the box a little bit, and I'm not too sure why. I think that's just, it's the day and age we live in, I guess. But yeah, put your neck out. Just do it, have a crack. And if you're unsure, just email someone who might be a bit more in the know, I guess. I mean, I'm always happy to take an email. I speak to parents, I speak to teachers. It's never a problem, and I am more than happy to have those conversations. In fact, you'll regret having those conversations with me because you won't get me off the phone, don't give me your number because you definitely won't get me off the phone.
Have you by any chance seen the documentary Motivation Factor?
I haven't, no.
Oh, there's your Friday night sorted. Fantastic documentary way back from the 60s of last year at high school in America. I think it's right up your street. I think you'll love it.
Yeah.
Some great stuff in there. I mean, unreal footage of, like, yeah, if you look at a PE class there and a PE class today, it's pretty stark contrast. But yeah, some pretty outstanding, just, you know, physical specimens from, you know, not necessarily sporting prowess, but just physical training, as, you know, was expected of norm. So I think that would be right up your street if you haven't watched
that. Bill Kennedy's thing, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think I've read about it. Yeah. Amazing. I'd love to have something like that in the UK. Would be awesome. Yeah.
Be unreal. So for those who want to keep up to date with what you're doing and your work and, you know, the latest manuscripts you're putting out, where's the best place to track you down?
Probably the best place, I guess, is either Twitter. So Ash Cox on Twitter. I think it's AshCox16, I think. Must have been too many Ash Coxes. So you can find me on Twitter. It's all a little bit more serious and highbrow, I guess, like it has to be. And then there's my Instagram as well. So Ash Cox, you can find me on there. So I've got an open profile. Feel free to follow me on there. The only issue you got there, you might have my kids and my wife in that. So if you're looking for some just information, there's three of us who kind of run a kind of information center, I guess, for like PTs and coaches and parents, and it's called Redwood Performance. So we're on Instagram, and it's just essentially infographics about what the latest research and stuff is. It's been a bit quiet, in all honesty, and I'll hold my hands up, for probably the last couple of months. So I've been busy with a new job and the end of my PhD, and one of the other guys has just started a new job, and then another one is just at the end of his PhD. So we're all kind of PhD level, and I think it's all coming to the end for all of us at the same time. But once, you know, when we're back up and running, we'll be putting information on there quite a lot as well. That's worth having a look at.
And obviously, a lot of your manuscripts, or potentially all of them, are available on ResearchGate. Is that right?
Yeah. So yeah, I've got a ResearchGate profile. Everything on there is available. All the papers we publish to date are open access as well, I believe. So you know, you can search for them and find the papers there. And you know, if you do have any questions around any of the methods or any of the findings or the outcomes, then you know, I'm happy to take those questions via email, I guess, is the easiest way.
Brilliant. Well, thanks again for your time today, mate. It's been great chatting, and yeah, I love what you're doing. So keep it up.
No problem. Thanks for having us on. I mean, I think we said this on via Instagram. I don't expect to come on to anything like this. I just kind of crack on with my work in the background. So massively appreciate you having me on. And full credit goes to, I guess, my wife for putting up with me, for putting up with the tantrums, the all-nighters at times, and obviously to the supervisory team as well, who have kind of guided and influenced this journey as well. Like, I couldn't ask for a better supervisory team, in all honesty. They've been superb throughout, from kind of reassuring me that I wasn't just an imposter all the way through to this point now, and hopefully beyond as well. So.
If you enjoyed this episode, there's a number of simple things you can do to help support the podcast. First, hit subscribe on your chosen podcast player so you're kept up to date with the latest episode releases. Second, you can leave us a review to help us reach more coaches and parents like yourself. Third, you can send this episode on to a coach or friend to help spread the word. And then fourth, you can find us on social media.